So yeah, our next speaker is Jeff Calvert. He's also our moderator. Jeff has been the project officer for our sensor pesticide project for 18 years, and it really has been my great pleasure to work with Jeff over the years. He's a great guy and very easy to work with, so thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. Very kind.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about the some recent findings from our sensor pesticides program. And for the benefit of people who may not know much about the sensor pesticides program, there's probably only a few of you in the room, but we're a state-based surveillance program. We began in 1987. We're a sentinel identification and follow-up program, meaning that pesticide poisoning, they should all be preventable. Really, we should have no cases being identified. They shouldn't exist. So if we do identify a case, we need to find out as much as we can about that case and then use that information to prevent additional cases in the future. So we have a standardized case definition, standardized variables. We have like over 100 variables. So we try to get a lot of detail on each of the cases that we identify. And we have a severity index. We use multiple ascertainment systems to identify cases. The three most important ones are poison control center data, workers' compensation data, and reports from the State Department of Agriculture, since it's the State Department of Agriculture that is responsible for enforcing the pesticide regulations in the state. So typically, the Department of Agriculture will hear about adverse events involving pesticides. So the program is funded by both EPA and NIOSH. Federally, and then also the states that collaborate in the program also provide support. And we have a website if you're interested. You can just Google sensor pesticides. These are the states that participate in the program. So they're colored in green. The states with the yellow star are the states that receive federal funding. And I think this is all going to change, I guess, in around July. With the new competition, so I'm not aware of which. I have a clue as to which states will continue to get funding, but as of today, this is what the picture looks like. So there's 12 states. So what we use this data for, and I think our program has been very effective. And I'm going to, in the next couple of slides, I'll show some of the impacts of our findings. But we can use our data to determine if preventive actions are effective. And principally for the agricultural industry, there's a part of FIFRA, part of the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act called the Worker Protection Standard, which was pretty much it's been around for many years, but there was a major revision in 1995. So we could use our data to see if that revision has been effective. We can use our data to look at trends in illnesses for all occupations, but for this presentation, we're interested in farm workers. And then we can also use our data to tell a human story, kind of tug at your heartstrings, and then give you the surveillance data once we've pulled you in. So this data shows it's the rates of pesticide-related illness. The black line at the upper part is our agricultural workers, and that blue line way at the bottom are all other workers. You can see on the x-axis we have year, and we have incidence rate per 100,000 on the y-axis. So you can see that the rates in agricultural workers have been pretty much steady since 1998, since that revision I talked about for the Worker Protection Standard. And it's about a 30-fold higher rate in agricultural workers compared to all other workers, so indicating that there's still a problem. So I'm not showing the data. It was even more of a problem before, but still there's more work to be done here. And so as a result, EPA, which is responsible for regulating pesticide use, proposed a new expanded strengthened worker protection standard in 2014. So it's the first major revision since 1992, so over 20 years. And the intent of those regulations are to protect agricultural workers from pesticides. And so the intent for the revisions were to make many, many revisions, including requiring that farm workers be trained annually. So currently they only have to be trained every 5 years. There's requirements for pesticide or for respirator usage. So currently there's no, if the label says that you have to wear a respirator, there's no requirement that you have to be trained on how to use a respirator. There's no requirement that you have to be taught on how to use the respirator. There's no requirement that says that you have to be healthy enough to wear a respirator. So all those requirements are going to be in this new standard. There's going to be age restrictions. I think currently, this new revision is says that you have to be at least 16 to apply pesticides, any pesticides. It's going to establish more buffer zones, so I could, I guess, go on here. But if it gets passed, it will provide many new protections for agricultural workers. And I guess, so this was originally published in March of 2014, and I think sometime this summer, maybe in the fall, they're going to announce the final regulation. So the EPA is working hard on it. And we were excited that a lot of the data that they used to justify the need for this standard was our sensor pesticides data. So we think it's a major impact of our program. And these are four of our publications that were cited in that, in the revised standard. So these reports are due to the fine work of many of the people in this room who participate in the sensor pesticides program. So, but there's one thing that's not included in this new revised standard. So I'm going to talk about a story that took place in Washington State back in 2014. And in 2014, for some reason, there was a whole rash of off-target drift incidents. Most of them involved sulfur, but there was one incident that we described. We published it in MMWR in January of this year. So I'm going to go over that. And what this report raised attention to was the issue of off-target drift. So that's still a very important issue. It's probably the most common cause of pesticide poisoning in agricultural workers. It also raised attention to some newly available agricultural pesticides, and I guess I use new liberally because these pesticides, although there were no previous published reports, reporting illness from these to humans, these pesticides were introduced into the market in the 1990s and early 2000s for the most part. And then also there's a gap in the worker notification requirements that this report identified. So as I mentioned, it occurred in April 2014. So these pesticides were being applied to a pear orchard to prevent Scylla infestations, which is a major pear insect pest. It reduces the plant's photosynthetic capacity, and basically what it does is it causes the trees to deform fruit, which then have reduced marketability. And so what they were applying in their air blast sprayers was a mixture of all these different pesticides, including novalurin, pyridobin, triflumazole, mineral oil, boron, and phosphoric acid. So the first three were the three pesticides that were of most concern. And even with the pyridobin, it requires that the applicators wear air purifying respirators and hoods, pretty much almost like a spacesuit. So next to this pear orchard was a cherry orchard. So they started doing the application to the pear orchard early in the morning, like 7 or 8 in the morning. The wind speed at that time was pretty low. And then, I guess, by around lunchtime, noon or 1 o'clock, it was a big pear orchard. By noon or 1 o'clock, they approached the edge of the pear orchard, which bordered a cherry orchard. And at that same time, there was a crew of workers who were descending into the cherry orchard to do some work on the cherry tree. So again, remember, this is spring. There's not a lot of foliage on the trees. You could pretty much see through, and these are all pretty young trees, so you could see, you should be able to see that the workers who were doing the tying the branches of the cherry trees to improve their fruit yields, but the applicators denied seeing those farm workers in the cherry orchard, and so they kept on applying the pesticide, and basically all of them got exposed. The drift, the workers were scattered across that cherry orchard from 30 feet to 350 feet from the edge of the orchard. The applicators were wearing their full PPE. The farm workers, all of whom were women, except for there was one man, were just wearing their typical clothes that they wear working in the fields. Average age was 33 years for these women. So there's some disagreement as to when the applicators first observed these farm workers. And so, and there's also a story that one of the farm workers went up to the applicators and tried to get them to turn their machines off, and the applicators were like, "We've got to get this job done. We don't think this is an issue." So within minutes, the farm workers started getting ill. Somebody called 911. EMT arrived, decontaminated five of the workers, and transported them to the local emergency department. Eventually, a total of 16 workers sought health care, and so all these workers got sick though, but 16 of the 20 got sought health care. And when there was some follow-up with several of the workers at least 2 weeks after the event, and of the workers who were identified, 75% of them continued to have problems. So six workers had moderate severity illness, meaning it was severe enough to require medical attention. 14 workers had low severity illness, which generally are illnesses that are going to resolve without medical treatment. But still, you know, these are things like nausea, vomiting, severe headaches. So it's not something, you know, if you get those symptoms yourself, you're thinking, what's wrong? Am I going to survive? It can be a scary several hours. And then these are the health effects that were documented. Everybody had neurologic effects, including several with headaches, paresthesias. Almost everybody had GI effects, nausea, vomiting. 85% had eye effects, including eye irritation, and 80% had respiratory effects, upper respiratory irritation, shortness of breath. So I guess I didn't talk about how this event got reported to the health department. So what happened was, so these workers got sick, and they at least one of the workers notified an advocacy organization, and then the advocacy organization notified the local newspaper, the Wauhatchie World, and then the Wauhatchie World wanted to get some comments from the health department about this, so they called the health department to find out, are you aware of this, and you know, are you going to comment on it? And so as a result, then I think the health department called the agriculture department, or it might have been the newspaper may have called the ag department, who notified the health department. But so that's then how the state agencies found out about this, was through the newspaper. So when the agriculture department got involved, they took samples, but this is a good 3 days afterward, I think, before they got into the field. And so they obtained clothing samples, foliage samples from the wipe samples from like the outhouse, grass samples, and several of them, as you can see here, were found to have residue of the pesticides that were involved. So the limitations of this were that the workers were exposed to a mixture of pesticides, so we couldn't identify which specific pesticide was responsible for the illness. Some of these could have been false positives since we didn't have biological specimens, and none of these, there's no pathognomonic health effects related to, you know, these pesticides. The health effects are pretty vague, general, so we couldn't say that this picture is consistent with this pesticide, therefore there's nothing else that could have caused this illness. So as a result, you know, we don't know for sure that all of these were truly pesticide poisoning. And as I've mentioned here, the residue samples were collected late, so if we would have gotten in there earlier, we could have had maybe even more more samples that were positive. So one of the problems here, the reason that the that this whole thing happened was because the cherry orchard was never notified about this application. And although the worker protection standard says that that a grower must notify the workers on their farm and let them know that an application is going to occur, there's no requirement that you have to notify your neighbor. So in this instance, the neighbor, you know, there's no, basically no buffer zone. The neighbor was never notified. So these farm workers working in the cherry orchard come marching into the field having no idea that there was going to be an application going on. And I guess on both of these farms, there was a recent change in management. And before, the old managers knew each other, communicated with each other. They would let the other farm know if there was going to be an application. But these new managers weren't aware of this relationship, and so there was no type of notification that took place. So the lack of notification actually is a not uncommon factor for these illnesses. So the Washington State Department of Health looked at their data, and they identified that for about a third of the cases involving farm workers between 2005 and 2012, a third of them involved off-target drift of pesticides to neighboring farms. But I guess you have to take, you know, one limitation here is if your workers are getting sick from your neighbor's exposure, you're going to report that to the health agency. Whereas if your workers are getting sick from your own exposure, it's less likely those cases are going to get reported. You're probably going to want to cover that up. So there's some maybe reporting bias here that could be responsible for that pretty high proportion. And also the California Department of Public Health documented a similar problem with lack of notification in 2005, again in the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. So the WPS, the current WPS, prohibits applying pesticides in a manner that results in contact with workers or other persons. However, at least I find this language to be vague. So it doesn't say directly if you see somebody you should stop the application. So you kind of have to make the judgment, okay, I see somebody, but are they far enough away that they're not going to be contacted? So I would make the argument that if you see bystanders, you should stop the application, get them out of the way.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Do you know what kind of risk communication was done to the however many people got sick? And was the health department involved in that?
You mean afterwards?
Yeah, I mean, here were all these people that have gone and, you know, been treated for this exposure. What was the follow-up with the actual cases?
So the health department, you know, they did the investigation, they interviewed all the workers, got their histories, found out what happened to them, followed up with them tried to get a hold of them at least a couple weeks after the event. I would assume that they provided information to them. They also have this farm worker advocacy organization in that area that's also been working with them. So they've got an attorney. I think they've been suing that pear orchard. So there is a lawsuit involved. I don't know what the outcome of that is. One of the farm workers actually took out her cell phone and videotaped the application, and also when the ambulances came. But because of this lawsuit, they've asked us not to show that video. But it is kind of neat that, you know, with the cell phones now, these workers can easily capture video to support their claims.
The regulators did investigate, I assume, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. They investigated. They wrote a report. Issued some.
Cited yet, or is that kind of in process still? Sometimes it takes a while.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the report, but I haven't seen any fines.
Ooh.
That's a good question. I mean, they were still working, I think, on the on the fines, and I haven't seen that part of it, but they did produce a nice report. And again, they interviewed all of the workers, interviewed the applicators, and wrote a nice report. So these are some of the things that we're currently working on. We're close to finishing a manuscript documenting Paraquat and Daquat. And so we've identified about 25 fatalities from Paraquat. Several of those by people pouring the Paraquat into unapproved containers like soda pop bottles, Coca-Cola bottles, Dr. Pepper bottles, and then people not knowing that that's Paraquat and taking a little sip, and you know, within a week or quicker even, you're dead. And it's kind of a slow, painful death. Burns your esophagus, so it's very painful, and then it pretty much causes your lungs to shut down, causes kidney failure, and it can take up to a week to die. And it's, you know, if you get a certain dose, then it's 100% fatal, but it just takes time to die. So we're documenting that, and hopefully we can get some more. Like, the Paraquat is banned from use in Europe and a few other countries, so I don't know if we can get it get that type of action taken, but at least try to get some increased strength in the regulations to protect workers. And then food processing industry, which John talked about, he mentioned folks from the state of Washington, Michigan, other states, and documenting the problem with disinfectants in the food industry, food processing industry. We wrote a paper in 2005 on pesticide exposures at schools, and we've been talking that it's time to update that paper, because that seems to be a big issue. Problems with acrolein, especially in Washington State, document fatalities related with that and very high severity illnesses related to that. And then our next talk, it is going to be talking about palladin, dimethyl disulfide exposure and illnesses potentially related to that.
So Jeff, I was wondering, in our next meeting for the pesticide state, would it be worth reviewing those materials on Paraquat and Daquat that I sent you to see if we wanted to do some sort of outreach scheme?
Can you remind me what materials you sent?
On Paraquat and Daquat, evidently EPA has developed some. Remember I was saying that EPA? Maybe not.
Yeah, I don't remember that.
Okay.
Well, EPA is a co-author on that paper, so we are working on that whole problem, documenting that. And so, if you've got some materials, we could
definitely
talk about that.
That might be a good thing. I'll send it to you. Yeah.
Okay.
I was wondering, going back to the issues with the gap in notification for the neighboring farms, if there's any policy changes that are in the works resulting from that.
Not that I'm aware of. So there was, you know, the proposed standard was published back in March, and they. EPA opened it up for comments, and I think the comment period ended in September. So it's been kind of a blackout period now, and this paper didn't get published until January. So right now I think they drafted up the final rule. I haven't seen it. They've been kind of sending it to like OMB, Office of Management and Budget, and USDA, to make sure that they're all in agreement on the final rule. So whether or not it addresses this neighbor notification, I'm not sure, but just informally, EPA's told me that that's something that's really hard to do.
Well, and isn't it, technically, the drift to a neighboring farm is illegal in itself,
mm-hmm.
So you shouldn't have to notify them because you're not supposed to be doing things that cause drift.
Mm-hmm.
But
true, but so, you know, it doesn't it doesn't make sense that you're required to notify the workers on your farm,
mm-hmm.
but there's no requirement to notify the guys who are just, you know, on the other side of that fence.
Right. But technically, they're already not supposed to.
So yeah, that could be an argument that EPA could make, saying, look, you're not supposed to be drifting.
You
drift
say,
is illegal.
You have to notify them what we're saying. You can't do it.
You can't drift, right. Uh-huh. Steve?
Two questions, one on the drift and one on reporting. At my understanding of the rules about application is that when they are starting to apply, they need to measure the wind speed, and it has to be below a threshold.
Mm-hmm.
That's at the start of the day when wind speeds are always lowest. Mm-hmm. By noon, wind speeds are usually higher.
Mm-hmm.
Is there no requirement for them to repeatedly document the wind speed?
I don't want to be quoted on that, but in, you know, in fairness to the applicators, that they did measure it in the morning and it was low, and I think they would periodically remeasure it, and we do have documentation from a local weather station that the wind speeds had gone up to around 18 miles per hour, and you're not supposed to apply these pesticides when wind speeds exceed 15. So they were, you know, in violation of that requirement. But whether or not they measured that themselves and documented it, I think, well, the paperwork that we have on the application, because the applicators are supposed to fill out paperwork on an application, and as I recall, it only had the wind speeds at the time they started the application. I don't think there's a requirement to document wind speeds once you've started it.
Yeah. So that sounds like a gap in the regulatory control of drift if the applicators are not required to.
Mm-hmm.
Because we all know that wind speeds are lower in the start of the day
mm-hmm.
than they are in the middle of the day. That's
right.
Well,
you're supposed to follow the label. The label is the law, the pesticide label. And so if the label does say don't apply this pesticide when the wind speeds exceed this velocity, I would assume that, you know, the regulators could get those weather records and show the applicator, look, we have documentation that you exceeded, you know, you applied this when the wind speed exceeded this velocity, therefore we're going to cite you. I would think an applicator would want to protect themselves.
Enforcement actions generally get the attention of, yes.
Right. But, you know, there's not many regulators out there who are enforcing these regulations.
And then the question on reporting is, I'm a little surprised, that since ambulance was sent, the pre-hospital medical care providers did stuff. They transported a half dozen people, I think you said, to the hospital
mm-hmm.
where they were treated. Somebody in the hospital should have reported that to at least the poison center, which means that because of our system, we would get those cases the next day. And clearly that didn't.
So that didn't happen, and that's not unusual.
That's why I say I'm not hugely surprised.
Right. So
we
get very few records directly from the healthcare providers.
Yeah.
Very, you know, maybe 1-2%, I want to say. It's a very low proportion that we get directly from the healthcare providers.
A lot of medical care facilities, on the other hand, are telling their providers, you don't need to do the reporting, we will do it for you.
Mm-hmm.
So the emergency department as a organization should be doing the reporting. Doesn't matter whether it's mm-hmm. the individual physician,
but even
the hospital required reporting.
Yeah, but we're not seeing that either.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's mostly from workers' comp. I think in Washington State it's workers' comp and poison control are the primary sources of
right.
cases.